Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of We Got This Podcast. A couple of months ago, Alexis McAvoy, the Chief People Officer at Chapter, was in this very virtual studio to talk about the culture work they've been doing at the company. She walked us through the process they went through and talked about the need to determine organizational priorities and values and how they intersect with culture. She also stressed the importance of leaders embodying the desired values and behaviors. And she sang absolute songs of praise about her CEO doing just that and being very supportive throughout the entire process. If you haven't already, I highly encourage you to listen to that conversation. At the time, I joked it would be really good to have her CEO as a guest to understand his point of view of the opportunities and the challenges involved in the entire transformation process. The more I thought about it, the more I realized it wouldn't just be a good idea. It would be a great idea. It's something that I had to do. So you probably know where I'm going with this by now. This week's guest is none other than Kobi Blumenfeld-Gantz, who, as the CEO and co-founder of Chapter, is a very busy man, and rightly so, because Chapter has recently become recognized as a Forbes 2023 Next $1 billion Startup and a Fortune Impact 20 company. Just as a reminder, Chapter is the industry-leading Medicare navigation platform that helps simplify and optimize Medicare for patients, customers, and clients. We Got This showcases individuals and organizations that create people-focused workplace cultures to help it become the norm rather than the exception. It's something that will require a mindset shift, and probably not something that any of us can do alone. But together, we got this. Kobi, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Thank you for joining us here. Without further ado, we'll get straight into the icebreaker question that no guest escapes. When you were little, who did you want to be when you grew up?
I played pretty competitive soccer when I was little, and so I wanted to be a professional soccer player. Because of my name, Kobi Jones was always the player I looked up to. Usually the sports player that people think about when they say the name Kobi is Kobe Bryant. But Kobi Jones actually spells his name the same way I do. And so I was always, both that and because he actually played soccer, which is the sport I played, was always interested in following Kobi Jones's path.
Wow. I'll admit, when I was talking to Alexis, she mentioned your name. And after we disconnected, when I Googled you, I did spell it the Kobi Bryant way. Apologies. I've learned. Now I know better. What position?
I played outside midfield. Primarily.
Oh, okay.
And on the left side in particular, because I'm right-handed, right-footed, but I noticed pretty early on that no one else, especially at a young age, could use their left foot or their opposite foot. And so I just spent an entire season only playing with my left foot. And then I got pretty good with both feet and became pretty valuable on both sides. So generally played on the left because other people weren't as able to at that age.
Okay. Judging by the success you're having with Chapter, what on earth has gone wrong?
at my soccer journeys?
Indeed.
I got injured, actually, in high school. I had some pretty bad injuries, which took me out for about a year and a half. And at that age, if you're out of the game for a year and a half, it's very, very hard to come back.
Was it one injury or a series of different injuries that just compounded?
It was one core injury and then a series of follow-up ancillary injuries from it, where it just made it really hard to train at the level that I had been.
Wow. This is something about it. I'm very much interested in sports and something, physical activity is just a day-to-day part of my life. But when I speak to people, and I know a lot of people who are now amateur athletes, but they often say that they had a path from early days that often was derailed by some sort of injury. And this being football players, basketball players, any type of kind of athletes, marathon runners and things like that. It always kind of fascinates me what happens, that how can we prevent that in a way, in young players, that we don't in a way overtrain? Is it overtraining? Is it lack of physical ability? It always kind of baffles me how many fantastic players we could have had in different sports if it wasn't for that.
Yeah, I mean, our bodies aren't probably not meant to operate at such an intense physical level, especially at that age. So yeah, I think the sports people have just become so good so early, and they train so hard at very early ages. I think there's this crazy fact that the men's, like under 13 or under 14, professional team, national team, generally beats the women's professional team because they are just training so hard at even 13 and 14 years old. And even at that age can physically keep up with the national female team, which is just wild. Like it's not healthy.
Yeah. That is insane. I had no clue. Wow. Right, Kobe. There's a very strong risk we're going to continue talking about sports. I'd love to, but I might have to start a separate podcast for that. If I do, you'll be the first one I call. So I'll pull the plug on this conversation just to be on the safe side. One thing that I would love to start with, because there's something I'm increasingly getting more and more annoyed by, and that is the fact that the word culture in the context of a workplace has become a buzzword, and I would really love to know what culture means to you from the position of a CEO who has to manage multiple things inside of as part of running the business. I don't want to ask you for a definition per se, but how would you describe what does that mean to you? Is it a buzzword or does it have some sort of meaning for you?
It's definitely a buzzword. Like most buzzwords, it has meaning as well, or should have meaning. For me and for us, I do care a lot about culture as a company. And when I say that, I mean that I care about the orientation that our team has when they're making decisions, both strategic and tactical day-to-day decisions. As we grow, it's really hard for any one person to be involved in every conversation. I'm not involved in most conversations anymore. And the team needs to be making decisions that align with the way that I think we should as a company and as an organization be making decisions and treating our members, treating each other. I think that's where cultural elements matter the most. If we build a really strong culture, we can get through and solve a lot of problems that we face. And that's kind of why I care about it. It's less because of, you know, we want to have team events or we want to have, you know, that stuff is like very much tertiary to me. Like it's fine. I'm glad people are having fun, but I don't actually care that much. What I care about is how does it inform people's decision making and how we treat each other on a day-to-day basis, especially when I or another leader isn't in the room.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's what makes culture a buzzword. People thinking ping pong tables, free coffee, and usually bean bags, right? That's association culture. I love the fact what you said about the elements that inform people's decision, and elements of culture that inform people's decision-making process. What elements do you most look for, look after? Which ones are the most important for you in that respect?
I look at how do people make trade-offs and what are people willing to trade off against. Generally, I think of us, and I think we are a pretty mission-driven company. And what that means is we put our members' interests above our own interests. And that means we have to explicitly say we are going to sacrifice something at the expense of the company for our members. And in our case, that's often revenue. So we will enroll people in Medicare plans on which we earn no revenue when we could enroll them on a plan that does pay us. But we do this because it's so important to our mission and to making sure Americans are on the right health insurance. And I think culture is an aspect of that where people need to be willing to make the right trade-offs that align with our members and align with our long-term interests as opposed to short-term interests. So I look for mission orientation. I look for people who care about solving a real problem and not just making a dollar. I think fortunately in our business, we can do both at the same time, but people who are first motivated by making a dollar tend to be more short-term oriented, which tends to actually erode long-term value.
In a way, I'm going to skip ahead because in my mind, I've got a few questions that I wanted to ask you, and you already prompted one of those, and that is related to revenue. I love that you have that such an element that you prompt people to put customers first, even at the expense, at the cost of revenue, and you look for people like that. With employees, I get that. But then I'm sure you've got stakeholders, that you've got some sort of board within the company. For me, straight away, a light bulb goes on. It's like, what do they say? Because often it's the other way around. We prioritize revenue in most other companies. Most companies have the profit margins, the revenue as their northern star. And I'm always conflicted about that. I'm not saying money's bad. It's just the approach that we've got to it. So how do you have these conversations? What happens there? How do you, you know, you getting employees of that sort that you described, I get that. But how do you instill that type of mentality in people who, you know, really care about how the company's run? And for example, I don't know whether that's going to cost you your job as a, even though you're a founder of the company.
I mean, look, we do care about revenue. I care about revenue. The whole team cares about revenue. And I'm not saying we don't. It's important to make a business work and to grow a business. And it allows us to be more impactful over time and support more and more Americans. It's that we have hard constraints on how we will generate that revenue. And we will not cross certain lines. And I actually don't think that's unique or even rare. I think many, many companies, especially those that start with a mission of solving a really important problem, a societal problem in particular, they have that and they align with that. That was consistent. My last job, I worked at Palantir with Alexis actually for a long time. And a lot of companies won't do business in certain countries for that reason. So I think it's fairly common. I'm just really clear with potential investors and our investors since the beginning that this is what we're doing. This is how we're building the company. And if that's what you want, amazing. If not, then we're not a good partner. And I think as long as you're clear about that up front, it aligns well. Our board is very supportive. I've never had issues or even had to have conversations about it because it's so ingrained into the culture, not just the team, but also our board and how we talk about everything. And that goes to how we've even oriented every conversation since the beginning with the board around how do we make sure we're solving the true problem and not just another version of a company that's exacerbating the problem. I think when you frame it in terms of actually solving problems in society, then it becomes way easier to orient everyone around a long-term vision that creates value. Like generally people assume correctly that if you create value, you can monetize it. I think that's usually correct. And it's similar here. We can create value, we can solve a big problem, and we can monetize it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I often see that with small companies and startups. They start with some sort of value, some sort of mission. They build something, and for them, genuinely, revenue is in a way, you know, obviously, as you said, they care about it, but it's in a way secondary. It's about the value, it's about building a product, and so on and so forth. When it starts to slip, is when they grow. Usually, when investors come on board, there are a lot of, and it's very, very visible in the IT industry, I think, because there's a bunch of tools that I'm not going to name that I use in the work that I do, both as a workplace culture designer, as a facilitator, as a podcaster, that when they were small, they were fantastic tools. But as soon as they started growing, and you just know that when additional investors started coming on board, when the quality of the tool started to drop, because new features were being introduced, more to drive revenue rather than focus on the usability of the tool and appeal or to the user base. And that's kind of the struggle that I've got, that I get what you're saying, that having a board and everybody else aligned that, but that must be a hell of a task to keep everybody and finding people who agree with that. And I think that takes guts and a lot of resolve on your part to be able to potentially walk away or just say, listen, okay, in that case, you know, we've got different values. Let's just go in different directions.
I think it depends. Like even in the example you mentioned, the argument could be made that they're actually destroying revenue, right? If they are producing features that are annoying you and eventually you churn, they are diminishing revenue. And so it depends on the company and the product and all these things, but could very easily imagine a conversation about being long-term oriented as opposed to short-term oriented and saying over 3 years, we're actually going to make more money if we do it the mission aligned way and less money if we do it the near term revenue generating way. So I think they actually are very aligned often, revenue generating activities and mission aligned activities, especially when the user is paying for a thing that you're solving or like that's the revenue model. If it were, you know, how does the company or the product cut all costs? Often, you know, it's customer support and other things like that. Again, and then you churn, it's going to be terrible user experience and going to destroy revenue. So I think they actually do hold each other accountable. And I don't think it's bad. That's where I really think it's actually good to have revenue driving orientation among the team as long as it's long-term oriented and aligned with the mission.
Absolutely. You're right about the churn. So for example, there's some tools that I just, I still continue to use simply because I don't use it often enough to justify the cost of change. And I don't mean monetary cost of change, but the cost of time and energy to use a new tool. But the level of frustration, I remember there's a bunch of tools that I absolutely loved using at the very beginning when I first began using them. When they started tweaking them and adding features that just didn't make sense and made it actually more convoluted for me to use that tool, I lost every ounce of joy of doing that. And that's really, really frustrating. Not to mention the fact that it's just made a lot of processes that I've had much more difficult. Yeah. But by the by, in a way, I'd love to pull us back a little bit to the conversation I had with Alexis and the entire process. She described what she's been doing, what she's been working on, and she's gone into the nitty gritty of it. And I don't want to be going in that direction because it's been covered. But what I'd love to know from you is from your side, what sparked that initial interest? Was it Alexis coming on board or coming up with saying, "Listen, we should do this"? Was it coming from you? What was the origin of that from your point of view within the organization?
You know, at a high level, I've always believed that the most valuable companies are those that have strong teams that make good decisions autonomously. And as we grow and as we scale, we need to more proactively do things to keep that culture and augment it and make it even better. A lot of that was learned for me, and I imagine for Alexis at Palantir. They have a very strange and wonderful and terrible and amazing culture all at the same time. There's a lot that goes into Palantir's culture, but I think one of the things they've been able to figure out really well, at least up to while I was there, was the ability to really indoctrinate people with the idea that every person needs to be solving a real problem in the world, with the mission alignment, working hard to drive that, and making decisions that are in the best interest of the customer. But I think because Palantir ingrained that culture so heavily and so successfully, the company is able to be pretty distributed, pretty autonomous. There's not a ton of hierarchy. I think there is a little bit more now, but there wasn't when I was for most of my time there. And those lessons and me seeing how effective the output of that was. Now, there's a lot that I don't think Palantir does well in terms of culture that we're trying to eschew as we build Chapter. But for the positive lessons, it's pretty obvious that as we grow the company, like, it takes work. You have to actually proactively do that. And so when Alexis and I were chatting before she joined, a lot of it was around, what do we want the company to be? And I'm constantly asking our leaders at the company, what do we want the company to be? And how do we build not just the Chapter product, but Chapter as a company is a product. We have to treat it as such. Otherwise, it will not have a great outcome.
You say that obviously you're constantly asking leaders, you're working with them, you're working with Alexis. In a way, I expect an answer in percentages, but how involved do you feel you are in that entire process? And how much is it actually that you are just, in a way, setting the beat, but then everybody else is doing what they feel needs to be done, because it's already ingrained, people are indoctrinated, as you said, with what it is that you're trying to achieve? Because I often say that obviously the CEOs have to, the people in charge have to set the tone, but often, depending on the stage the organization is at, they have to be more or less involved. I've got a feeling from what you're saying, from what I remember the conversation with Alexis, is that you are relatively-ish hands off. Would that be fair to say, or do you feel like you kind of at multiple touch points across? Because surely you've got plenty other things to do as a CEO than just working on culture.
It depends on the initiative or the way we think about it. On some things I'm less involved, on some things I'm more involved. But I think about it a little bit differently writ large. I think that every person at the company is creating culture every day, whether we mean to or not. It's just like, it happens. Like, we're a collection of humans. And so that's what a culture is. It's so every day that I operate, whether positively or negatively or in a neutral way, I am affecting the culture. And everyone at the company is. So I'm cognizant of that, even when I'm not building out a growth framework for teams or doing something that you might bucket in culture, I'm heavily involved. Even when we're doing things like, how do we set up different meetings and prioritization structures? How do we do quarterly planning? How do I engage with the team, give feedback? Like, these are not things that, like, you would bucket under this is a culture initiative, but all of these things are in many ways more important than like a lot of explicitly cultural initiatives. So in most ways, I'm heavily involved. But in some ways, I'm not at all.
By the way, you just gave a very, very short but amazing definition of culture by saying just, you know, culture is how people act together. So I absolutely love. And I'm pretty certain that's going to be a soundbite later on. But no spoilers. How do you manage that with all the other things that you do? Because in a way, what I'm hearing, you're saying that, you know, culture work for you is just the work of running a company, different initiatives, different processes, different things that you do, which, again, you wouldn't throw necessarily into the bucket of culture initiative. It's just, you know, operating as a business. How do you balance that with all the other things that you need to do, including Senate hearings that I know that you've attended recently, which must have been, I don't know, stressful, fascinating at the same time. But how does that fit in for you? How do you cope with that?
Probably not particularly well, but I think there's a tension and a balance. There are times when I want to just do a thing and get something done. And sometimes that's the right answer and I just do it. And there are times when the way that I do it actually is more impactful than the thing I'm doing. And so that's where Alexis is particularly helpful to me. I mean, she's helpful to the organization writ large, but in terms of things that she's helpful to with me personally, it's how do I approach a certain thing and do a certain thing that I want to do in a way that either enforces the culture we want or helps people understand why what they were doing is not the most effective or productive way to approach a thing. So a lot of it is just being mindful as we're going through normal course of business, how my actions and the actions of other leaders affect the company culture and have these rippling implications. And even the Senate hearing, like that was a huge cultural component for the team, because the way that I described what we do in our long-term mission and goals do stick out to people at the team. And it is something that's memorable to the team and becomes sort of ingrained in how people think about and talk about what we're doing.
I guess it must have given huge boost in terms of the significance of people's work to be recognized, not just within the company, but outside through such a thing as a Senate hearing, to be part of a much, much larger discussion that affects, you know, millions of people in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an amazing reminder to everyone to pick their head up a little bit out of the day-to-day tactical of what we're doing and help them realize that, of course, you know, every day we're helping many, many people with a personal decision, but at a high level in aggregate, that's meaningful to our society. And our approach has actually changed the way DMS and the Senate think about regulations in this space. And so we have, I submitted a written testimony before my spoken testimony, and the Senate Finance Committee took some of my proposals and said, we're going to incorporate these into our recommendations to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So it's like we're actually, as a team, changing the law, changing the way that these regulations are written, and through strong execution, moving the market, because other competitors are now forced to do things the way we're doing them to the extent they can, because they can't compete if they don't. And to me, that's amazing. Like, if we can force the entire industry to not be terrible and slimy, like, that's a win.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not that familiar with the US setup. I've never used it. I tend to hear bad things about it, as it tends to be. But, you know, also at the same time, show me a health service anywhere in the world that actually people are proud of. The UK with the NHS, they are very proud of the NHS as an institution, but the state of it at this moment in time is not very, very good. Elsewhere in the world, yeah, it's a little bit hit and miss to say the least. But I can recognize the importance of that, and that's what people are looking more and more, because we often see this, especially with the younger generations, and we say, oh, Generation Z and millennials or whatever, they're so picky, they're so lazy and things like that. To a certain extent, yes, that's true, but they need different things. They need to be looked at through a different lens. They need to be motivated in a different way. For them, it's not just a paycheck, as it was for our generation, for the previous generations, and so on and so forth, right? And it is these things, significance and meaning of the work that they do, that it fits into a bigger picture. Providing your basic needs of financial safety and so on and so forth are met, that's what you're going to be looking for. And that's more even more important. You mentioned sometimes that you work with, when you're working on different initiatives, you've got some personal challenges, and it's not what you do and how you do it, and the kind of balance of, you know, which one's more important. But I guess within the work that has been happening at Chapter internally around your values, around the transformation, as a person, as a human being, what have been some of your personal challenges? What have made some kind of alarm bells start to ring for you, or where you felt that you have to do some deep searching internally in yourself to be able to overcome?
Dealing with people is always hard. We're very complicated and multi-dimensional beings in many ways. I think sometimes it's taking action that are pretty obviously right for the organization, but very hard for the individual. So whether it's changing people's roles or titles, letting people go, changing people's compensation, it kind of, those are very hard emotionally, but I think to be done. And when I look back at regrets and learnings, I've never regretted these decisions, only I've regretted them not doing them sooner. And that's usually what you hear from people. The reality is that these decisions need to be made, and those can be very challenging. The flip side is when you have a strong mission with the company, it's a little easier to say, oh, I'm not just letting this person go because they are not effective or productive, or they're not a good ROI on their time relative to their pay. It's that they're actually doing a disservice to our members, and they're preventing us from accomplishing our mission. And so that's an area, that's one way I try to think about it, because it makes it just more clear that there is a cost, not just paycheck salary cost from the company's perspective, but there's a real cost to our mission and to Americans if we don't have the best team and the most optimized organization to get there.
Actually, that kind of preempts a question I wanted to ask you, because I knew you must have had or you must have encountered skepticism around what it is that you're trying to build within the organization on the ways of working and environment type level. How do you actually cope with that and overcome these challenges, or even not overcome challenges, but overcome these objections? And how do you justify then fitting that and connecting that to how the business performs at the end of the day?
Yeah. It goes back to setting ideally, we set these expectations and explain them before someone joins, like as part of the interview process, and then in onboarding and as someone joins. So when the shape of strategy or organizational orientation changes over time, obviously we need to shift people's views on that. People come from very different backgrounds, very different companies, different ways of operating. Some companies think about the world in one way, other companies think about the world in opposite ways. And it's really hard to get people out of the mindset of, my other company did it this way, I was there for 10 years and it worked pretty well. Obviously, that's the right answer. And the reality is not obviously the right answer. It might be, but it might not be. And so a lot of it is naming the thing and explaining that, like, we do actually need to think about these sometimes from a first principles perspective, sometimes pattern matching what works in other companies. I remember a specific conversation I had with one of our teammates who had joined, and he initially, there was a fair amount of friction because our engineering team pushes back on doing a lot of things. They don't just sort of take the sales or business team's direction. If business team says, hey, build X, they're not just going to say, okay, it's not like jump how high. It's really engaging and understanding, why do we need to build the thing? Do we need to build that now? In what way do we need it? What business outcomes does that thing drive? And that amount of friction, I think some people are not used to. I think it's very healthy and productive as long as it's constructive. But helping people understand that the best engineers and the best product people engage in that level, whereas at other companies, maybe they don't. Maybe it's like, you submit a ticket and someone does the thing. And it's a very different orientation and setup we have here, where technical teams do drive a lot of decisions. And I think that's important, and it creates much better outcomes over time.
I've got a twofold question on that, because I think it's so important point that is misunderstood. Friction and conflict within the organization is perceived as something very bad that we need to avoid, that which is completely untrue. Unhealthy, unproductive conflict and friction needs to be avoided. Productive one, absolutely not. That's fuel, absolutely, humongous amounts of energy that go into that.
Yeah.
That can be utilized. And if you don't utilize it, that's when it becomes a waste. So the twofold question is, what does that friction look like that you describe? Because I love that it must be a classic between engineering and sales. It's like sales and marketing is the same thing. If you could share a slide, a simple example of what that friction might look like. And second, how do you deal with that? You as a CEO, but also within the organization, do the teams do it themselves? Does Alexis get involved? How does that happen?
Yeah, there's the ideal and there's the exceptions to the ideal. Ideally, what happens is these teams talk to each other. They understand the context that they're both operating in and the constraints. We're all resource constrained and the relative prioritization of different things. And they're able to get to a decision of, we should build this. We shouldn't build it. We should build it later. We should build it now, but in a really scrappy way because it's, you know, it doesn't actually matter, but someone wants it. And ideally, they're able to get to those decisions on their own. When they're not, then it usually escalates to me. And sometimes we loop in Alexis to help have those conversations and structure that thinking, because it's really hard for people to articulate what's motivating their desire to do a thing. And the good thing about having people who are very smart and hardworking and passionate is that they believe in things with a lot of energy. And when those two collide, it creates that friction. So it's how do we make that as constructive as possible and take that friction and turn it into amazing output. So sometimes it's really digging into why people feel the way they feel, which sounds very soft and mushy, but it's true. Like, and it is hard. It can be hard to articulate written or verbal ways why you fundamentally believe a thing should be done in the way that it should be done. And it can take some time, both self-reflection and talk to other people to tease out the why. And then you kind of realize it might be about something else. It might be that you're worried or concerned about the future. It might be that you really, really want to help the partner or help the member. So that's where we really try to get to it in these conversations.
I can so relate to the fact that you've got people who really want to do good work, and that's sparks flying is just a byproduct. It's unavoidable, right? It's a question of how that's directed. And first, I think many don't realize that's what happens and what needs to happen, especially at different stages of team development. It's conflict is what is supposed to happen, first of all. But even if the team is well developed, then conflict, as I said, is that fuel that can be utilized. So absolutely. Great to hear that. Thank you very much for sharing a bit more insight into that. Something that is often puzzling to me in justifying the work that I do to my potential clients is, why should we do this? Why is it worth it for us? In usually the expected answer is in some sort of monetary terms of, you know, how is that going to help us? You've mentioned that a couple of times. You alluded to what the return on investment of any type of ways of working, improvements, and how you collaborate as a company, as a team, what benefits that brings. But is there a way that you found that is useful in to quantify the return on investment?
No, and I think it's kind of a waste of time to try. I think either you believe that these things are important or you don't. And if you don't, then that's fine and you shouldn't invest in them. But if you do, then you should. To me, the returns are pretty obvious. Like, it comes in people making better decisions faster. It comes in being able to recruit a better team. It comes in, you know, when you have good people, you can build better things and solve more problems. You know, over a longer time horizon, it's the difference between massive failure and massive success. I think, you know, there are probably a fair number of companies that have been successful without this, but I think the companies that are successful, that are very successful, if you think of, you know, the largest couple hundred companies in the country or the world, they're the difference between where they are and where, you know, being like a fine company that isn't particularly successful is probably the people culture. You know, there are exceptions, but that's generally my heuristic. So if we wanted to grow a little bit, be an okay company, you know, I'm sure we could get away without caring that much about culture. But if we really want to be a top company where people want to work, and, you know, Medicare is not the sexiest topic as it is, like, making it exciting for people and getting the best engineers, not just in Medicare, because there aren't really many good engineers who work in the space, but just like the best engineers writ large, which I think we have, it's through it's through these initiatives and caring about these things. Like, if you don't think you need good it comes down to, if you don't think you need good people to build an amazing company, then great. Like, don't have good people and don't care about these things. But if you do think you need good people to build an amazing company, then this is kind of the only way to do it.
I'm going to have to get my lawyer involved to draft a statement, some sort of agreement between you and I on royalties. Because what you've just said, the last minute or so, I'm going to be cutting this out, and it might be featuring heavily in my pitches, just to justify and as an answer to that question. So we might have to figure out some sort of agreement that you get royalties for that. But
I mean, it goes to this saying, what is it, that like, what can't be measured can't be managed, like that famous saying. That saying is actually apocryphal. The saying is you don't need to measure things for them to be managed. So the common conception of the saying is the opposite of what the author meant.
Really?
Yeah, it's wild. Yeah.
There you go. Okay. I've just learned something. I didn't realize. But there's a lot of sayings that we misattribute and most of all misunderstand. Wow. Okay. That makes sense, actually, if you think about it. But I couldn't agree with you more. It is, for me, in a way, you gave a fantastic ROI answer to that. Because for me, I don't think it can be quantified monetary in money terms. It's very, very difficult. At best, it's guesswork and it's indirect anyway. You can try and measure it in kind of employee satisfaction surveys, absenteeism, and so on and so forth. You can play around with that. That's a tangible-ish metric, but again, impacted by way many more things than just the environment. So that's the tricky bit. One final question I wanted to ask you, because I often get, I don't want to say accused, but I know that I get ahead of myself, because when I work with clients, I have these grand ideas of, you know, what should be done within the culture organization. I work with culture building blocks where we take things apart and build out from scratch, the design work on each of the culture building blocks, from mission to values, through how we communicate, how the leadership is performing, and what behaviors they want to have in the organization. And I often catch myself thinking, this is way too far, way too deep, way too quickly. Because the people I'm working with, they say, like, this is all nice and good, but actually I've got loads of day-to-day shitty little things that I need to deal with that I actually don't know how to do. What are some of the day-to-day kind of team challenges and around how you manage them that you as a CEO experience and actually need the most help with, rather than having grand visionary sessions about where your culture should be and what it should be?
A lot of the day-to-day things are like pretty mundane, like how do we run a specific conversation or a specific meeting, making sure people are able to talk, say what they want to say, and get to a decision that actually can move the company forward, and not just, okay, we need to keep talking or thinking about this, like actually expediting and making things move faster. That's a pretty common one, and it just shows up in day-to-day stuff. One common challenge is making sure the right people are, just all of the context is shared, because different people have different exposure to different aspects of a decision. So making sure that people have the right context to make the decision, otherwise it's very hard. You know, sometimes I can get excited about a thing or not excited about a thing, and people can read too much into it. Like, it's strange when people just kind of take my, like, there are times when I wish people just listened to me and did what I said, but usually that's not what I want. Usually, like, I'm asking questions and probing to get people to think more about it. I'm not trying to say like, yes, this is a good idea, or no, this is a bad idea. Like, we should or shouldn't do something. And it's hard sometimes to calibrate based on the person I'm talking to, how they are going to take a question or how they're going to take even a semblance of a directional push, and making sure that I'm not overruling or making people feel like they can't do what they were planning to do.
Actually, that makes me think of a very, very common scenario that I see. And if I may ask you how you see that and how you might potentially tackle a situation like that. When it comes to decision-making, when we've got, and it happens at all levels, if you're a team leader, head of department, a CEO, it doesn't matter, well, you've got a group of people and you want to make a decision on where to take the project, right? And you canvas people, you get people's opinions, and then the decision is made and people feel ignored, disgruntled, because the decision hasn't gone in their favor, or they felt like, well, why the hell did he ask me for my opinion if he went and did the opposite? I often see that as a misalignment of, you know, a misunderstanding of how the decision is going to be made, that it wasn't communicated, right? That the CEO could have said, the person could have said, listen, I'm getting everybody's opinion And then based on that, I'm going to make my decision. It might be against the one what you suggested, but ultimately it lies with me. Or say, I'm going to take everybody's opinion, then I'm going to justify that, and I'm going to make it based on what you tell me, right? How do you manage a situation like that? Do you face situations like that? And if so, how do you manage? Or what your advice would be in situations like that? Because I think it's very, very common.
I think we face different flavors of that. We don't face that quite exact situation. I think people generally understand that we won't always do what a specific person wants to do, including me. Like, we do things that I don't think are the right decision sometimes. I mean, sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. So yeah, I think it's less, I agree. It's important to make clear who is making the decision. One specific area where that used to come up is, especially earlier on, it was unclear to people that I made all compensation decisions at the company. And so I think people felt, both the managers and the individuals, felt sort of unclear or unsure of why certain compensation decisions were being made. And it did get a lot easier when I reminded people that I am making all these decisions. So I'm happy to talk about them, but it's my decision. So we can talk about it, but that's how it's being made. It's not some cabal of people, you know, deciding a thing. So yeah, I think your point is a good one. I'm trying to think of other decisions other flavors of that problem we face, but nothing's coming to mind immediately. Mm.
Because I think it boils down to clarity of what's going to happen, how it's going to be made, right? The people they've got full understanding what's going on. So they're not surprised. Because I've genuinely seen situations where in this particular case, it was a CEO who made a certain decision, didn't clarify the process. People were so annoyed that some of them left the organization. And that was, we're talking about that person's core team, C-level people from the company. I think it was based on the direction of the product, where the company's going to head. And ultimately, the CEO made the decision himself, which was always the case, but he failed to communicate that and had a hell of a problem on his hands as a result of that. So for me, it boils down to clarity. Kobe, I've got loads of questions. We don't have the time, but I'd love to ask them all. The only solution to that, I feel, is a third part. You and Alexis coming on together, and then we're fleshing it out. But we might have to book 2 hours for that for sure. But that being said, I'm curious, what's up ahead for you for the rest of the year, in the coming months, for you personally, for you at Chapter as well. Where do you go from here?
On our core product, our core business line to date, we've gone from, in some ways, I think even companies that are 20 years old are still going 0-1. But in some ways, we've gone from 0-1, and now we need to go from 1 to a lot. And so it's really about, how do we efficiently scale a high quality experience in our core offering? And then at the same time, starting to think about solving more problems for people that they face in retirement. It's not just about, Medicare is one of the most important parts of retirement, but it's not the only important part. So the reason the company is called Chapter is because we want to help people live the best chapter of their lives. It's not because we want to, only help people with health insurance. And so we're really starting to think about, how do we build on the trust we've created and build a broader platform that helps people navigate this phase of life? So those are the two things we're really focused on this year.
Right. Okay. And are there any exciting developments, anything that you're really looking forward to, you can't wait for the world to see in the coming months?
We're working on a few new features that allow people to basically just save a lot of money while using their health insurance plan. And I'm excited for people to start getting access to that over the next few months.
Fantastic. I'll be closely monitoring what are you getting up to. Not from a Medicare point of view, that means unfortunately very, very little to me, but definitely from how you do as a company, because in a way you are an exception. You are a unicorn in the cultural world, I would say, of how you run your organization and the work that you do throughout, not just you and Alexis, but everybody in the organization. Because for me, knowing that there are companies like that makes me more sane. The simple fact that it's not just me dreaming and being in a land of fairy tales and rainbows. I know the companies like that exist, and you existing and you doing the work that you do is fantastic, absolutely fantastic for me to hear. So thank you very much for the sake of my sanity. I do thank you. Keep up the great work.
I don't think that is correct, and I hope that's not correct, but I appreciate it nonetheless.
Kobe, thank you very much for your time.
Likewise. Great to be here.
Right, so that was the other side of the story at Chapter. So we've heard from Alexis McAvoy a few months ago, and now we've heard from Kobe, as the CEO of the organization, on the culture transformation, what culture means to them, what it looks like. But most of all, from a position of a CEO who has to manage multiple things within the organization, and brought us a little bit closer and gave us a little peek behind the curtain of what that means. And you can be sure that you'll be hearing more stories like that in the coming weeks and months. Thank you very much for tuning in. I was your host, Lech Wazowski. Until next time.